This is 4:55 on Wednesday, November 20th. Okay, good morning. Any questions about anything? Project? All right, so we were talking about RSA, and I mean, I think you've all seen this before, but we'll just go through a simple example. And like I said, I'll give you an example on the homework that requires you to go through this process and make sure that you understand the steps so that they can be done on exams if need be. So remember, we start out with two primes, and don't ever actually do encryption with these numbers, right? They're completely insecure because they're so small. But P and Q are 5 and 7, two primes. Their product is 35, and Z is P minus 1 times Q minus 1, 4 times 6, 24. So that's sort of setting up the basics of the system. Then we get to make a choice of E, which has to be relatively prime to Z. Choosing it to be a prime number suffices. Okay, and so then we have to find D, so that E times D minus 1 is divisible by Z. And I don't remember, anybody been taught an algorithm for doing that that's fast? I don't remember. There's a fast algorithm for doing it, but I don't remember what it is. Okay, so then we have E, D, and N. N and D constitute the public key, and N and E constitute the private key. And so to encrypt something, you raise the message to the power of E and take mod N. And I will trust their arithmetic here, unless somebody wants to run Python 3 with big number arithmetic and do it. I didn't go through and check it. There have been mistakes on the slides before, so it's maybe worth doing. So M to the E is 24,832. That looks vaguely right. And we take that mod N, and that gives us the ciphertext. So the original message was the number 12. The encrypted message is the number 17. And now at the other end, we raise the encrypted message 17 to the power D. So 17 to the 29th is that nice big number there. And take that mod N and you get back 12.
That number's missing an 8.
That number is, this number's
no,
missing?
No, the M to E.
Oh, yeah.
248,832. Yeah.
Very good. All right. See, I told you, mistakes on slides. Is this one right? 17 to the 29th. I'm getting a whole list of things I need to tell them about. On the chapter 5 assignment, the computations of the CRC checks, the solutions in the solution manual are wrong.
Yeah,
I
noticed that too.
Now, wait a second.
I wasn't sure I was doing the division right, so I wanted to just see.
Uh-huh.
And they got a completely different answer. I go, oh, must have done it wrong. So I redid the work. All right. And got the same answer again. Oh.
Yeah. Yep. They did the solutions for the previous edition of the book. So don't know why. So this number's right. All right, 824, it's 248832. Okay. It's great to have people able to do these checks in real time. So fine. And we talked about this slide last time. Why does it work? Because you have picked because there is the theorem that says that when you pick Z the way that we did, ED mod Z is 1. That's how we picked, that's how we picked E and D. So that ED mod Z was 1, and so when you've essentially raised the message to the power E, followed by raising it to the power D, and do that, when you've done that, what am I saying? Oh yes, right. There's the theorem that says M to the ED is equal to M to the ED mod Z, and we picked E and D so that ED mod Z was 1, and so therefore this is M to the 1. Essentially, the message originally. Okay, we mentioned this last time that decryption, that encryption followed by decryption is the same thing as decryption followed by encryption. In other words, using the public key first or the private key first doesn't matter. What's that good for? In the case of encryption, keeping a secret, you encrypt with the public key. Only the person who holds the private key can decrypt it. Okay? If you encrypt with the private key, only the person who holds the private key could do that. And therefore, somebody who can successfully decrypt knows that the message came from the person holding the private key. So form of signature. Okay, we'll see that a little later on again. So we talked also about why it's secure. Essentially, the problem is finding the factors of N without knowing them ahead of time, and factoring is hard. And of course, the other part of this is, how do we know that RSA is equivalent to factoring P and Q? I mean, that might be the obvious way to break RSA would be to factor N. But what if there were another way to factor N? What if there were another way to break RSA? If you're in 450, you've done NP complete proofs, right? Shown reductions from one, you show a reduction from the problem you want to say is NP hard to an existing NP hard problem. Similar proof here shows that if you could break RSA by some method, then you would have solved factoring. Okay? Factoring is only thought to be hard. It's not known to be hard. But this is, you know, I guess it depends on the definition of hard. Certainly in practice, right now, factoring big numbers is hard. Okay, so using RSA in practice, you don't really want to use RSA on all your messages because all these exponentiations and modulus operations on these great big numbers is computationally fairly expensive. So what you do is you use RSA to establish a symmetric key to be used for your session. All right, so you just do a limited amount of sort of public key cryptography work, and then use a symmetric key after that on all the traffic that you conduct with somebody else. In some of the research that we're doing, well, we're not using DES, we're using AES, but doing things with RSA might take sort of 40-ish milliseconds, and doing things with AES might take a few hundred microseconds. Okay, so ratios of 100 to 1 are important in practice, although theoreticians like to ignore them. Okay. All right. So those are some of the tools that we use. Let's now talk about the problems of actually using them in practice. And the first one is to do authentication of entities. So this is, I mean, remember I talked about authentication coming in two flavors. There's the flavor of how does Bob establish that he's really talking to Alice? And then once he's established that, how does he ensure that all the messages that he's getting from Alice actually come from Alice? So this set of slides goes through a number of attempts to figure out how to do this. So we start with something very basic where Alice says to Bob, "I'm Alice." Okay. And what can Trudy do? Well, Trudy can say, "I'm Alice." Right? So Trudy remembers the intruder. So if the protocol is simply Alice says, "I'm Alice," then that doesn't work because Trudy can say the same thing. All right. So what if Alice sends her IP address inside a packet and says, "I'm Alice"? Trudy says, "This is Alice's IP address, and I'm Alice." You know, and maybe Bob can't reply to Alice in that case because can't reply to Trudy in that case because Trudy doesn't have access to Alice's IP address. But maybe she does, right? Maybe she's able to take that over.
If Trudy wanted to be mean, couldn't she have Alice send the "I am Alice" but then spoof the IP address so it looks like it came from someone malicious, and then Bob won't want to talk to Alice? Wouldn't that be another?
That would be a kind of denial of service attack sort of thing where where Trudy prevents Alice's message from getting there. Okay. Alice sends a password. Bob replies. What does Trudy do? She records the message from Alice, later plays it back. Okay? Doesn't work. Alice sends her encrypted password. That doesn't help at all. Same thing, still works. Also, encrypted password, what are we going to do about knowing what keys to use? Right? Would sort of be Bob already knew something that Alice could use. Okay, so how to avoid playback attacks? There's the idea of something called a nonce. N-O-N-C-E. And what a nonce is typically a number that's used once in a lifetime, at least once in a lifetime of a protocol, once in a lifetime of the conversation of once in a lifetime of other things that Bob and Alice are using to set up their conversation. And the idea here is that Bob gets to pick something that's essentially a challenge to Alice. And he gets to pick it for every conversation that he has with Alice. So the idea of a nonce is that it's something that's just used once, and every time Bob and Alice want to come up with a conversation, Bob picks another one. So what do we do here? Alice says, I'm Alice. Bob says, I don't believe you. Prove it to me. Okay? So he sends her a random, essentially a random number that he picks. Alice encrypts that with a shared secret. And now Bob knows that Alice got this message and was able to encrypt it with the shared secret. And now what's wrong? Well, for one thing, it uses public key cryptography. It uses symmetric key cryptography. Could we do it with public key cryptography to avoid key exchange problems? Yes, we could. But what do we see here? She sends it encrypted with her private key. That's fine. Bob doesn't know her public key. He asks her for a public key. The public key is public. It ought to be okay to disclose it, right? That's not a secret. But we're essentially back where we started from. Because how does Bob know that this public key actually is Alice's public key? As opposed to somebody else's. So this sort of gets into a long, detailed picture of this that shows how Trudy can attack this protocol by essentially inserting herself into this conversation and sending Bob her public key at the appropriate time. Meanwhile, carrying on a conversation with Alice so that it looks like what's happened is that Bob has successfully authenticated with Alice, but Trudy is actually sitting in the middle and now gets a copy of the session key. Okay. We'll come back to solutions for that farther on. The thing that I've learned in working with this stuff over quite a few years now is that this problem of authenticating the other party is really the key problem in computer security at this point. All of the other stuff, the how do you keep messages secret, how do you ensure the integrity and authenticity of individual messages. There are lots of variations on those stories. And there are lots of good variations on those stories. But there aren't really good solutions to the how you know the other party is really who you're who you think they are. And part of that is because sort of societally, we don't actually have a solution to the question of identity for people and things. You know, we have driver's licenses that sort of were intended to show to the police officer that we've passed the driving test, right? It's sort of a token that says you've done all the things you need to qualify to drive. There's some steps were taken sort of over the years to ensure that Adam could only present his driver's license for that purpose, as opposed to mine, you know, pictures on the driver's license and things like that. But over the years, we've sort of extended the purpose of that driver's license to now be sort of a indicator of identity for other purposes, you know. How old you are, whether you're a citizen, all kinds of things. Passports, same way. And they don't translate into the digital world very well, right? So the question is, how in the digital world do we deal with questions of identity that are hard even in the physical world? And that's an ongoing challenge, I think, for computer science and e-commerce and all kinds of things. Okay, but there are easier problems, such as ensuring message integrity, which we'll talk about first, and then we'll come back to authentication again. So in the physical world, again, the creator of a document can sign it, scribble a signature. Let's think about that process a bit. Forgeries certainly happen, and the world has come to have sort of processes in place by which if somebody forges a check, say, with your name, you're protected, right? You're not liable for their signature on the document. It's only a valid signature if you actually intended to sign the document. If somebody tricks you into signing something that, they put one thing in front of you and you sign it and they copy the signature onto something else, or they wrote the actual document in secret ink and they make the secret ink come up, you're not liable for that. Because that's not the intention of a signature. The intention of a signature is to show that you really approved what it was that you were signing. And if it's forged, then society has processes in place to determine that and take advantage and sort of straighten things out. And that's going to be important when we come back later. Okay, so the goal, of course, is to have techniques that are verifiable and not forgeable, so that the recipient can prove to somebody else that the sender actually intended to sign this document. So, as we said before when we were talking about RSA, and public key cryptography, if you sign by encrypting with a private key, then the recipient can decrypt with the public key and get back, I think there's a picture on the next page, decrypt with the public key, and what's that? That plus belongs over there. My goodness. This is PowerPoint at work. What a mess. The pluses go there and the minuses go there. Anyway. It's a decryption problem, right? You write in code and you have to decrypt it. Okay. So, the point is that if you successfully decrypt the message and it matches the message that you got, then whoever signed M must have used Bob's private key. I believe that. Okay? That's a true statement. Alice thus verifies that Bob signed M. Well, look carefully at the definition. It says that
you usually try to assume that people hold on to their private keys.
Right. Okay? You usually try to assume that people hold on to their private keys. Yes, exactly. So, Alice thus has strong evidence, I would say, that Bob signed M. No one else signed M, and that Bob signed the message that she received and not some other thing. Alice and prove that Bob signed him. Well, no, not really. She can't prove that Bob signed him. She could prove that somebody signed M with Bob's private key. Right? Now, from a technical point of view, this is all fine. Right? This is the story we want to tell. But it seems to me that in having conversations with society at large, it's dangerous to formulate things in this way, right? Because when you tell a lawyer or a legislator or a judge these things, or a jury these things, sort of in that unconditional way, you're not telling the whole truth. And you're not allowing for things to have gone wrong outside of the cryptographic system. Within the cryptographic system, this is all fine. But in the real world, there are opportunities for mistakes. And you certainly don't want some poor guy who sort of managed to leave his private key sitting around somewhere to now be liable for whatever happens with it ever after. Right? There's got to be processes around this, just like there are for real signatures, to say, no, I didn't. You know? Yes, there's a strong presumption that you did, but there've got to be ways that are built in. And if you don't tell that to the public at large, then you get sort of bad legal frameworks for dealing with this stuff, in my humble opinion. Okay. So, back to the technological approaches. We said that encrypting with public keys or private keys was an expensive operation. We'd like not to do that for for large messages. So there's a technique that's been developed to reduce the amount of encryption that you have to do by hashing messages. And so the idea is that you take your large message, you run it through a hash function that picks up something smaller, that creates something smaller that nevertheless represents the message that you started with in some way. And you have to recognize and do some things in designing that hash function and using that hash function that are important. So, first of all, any hash function that reduces, that takes a message and produces a smaller thing as a result, necessarily is a many-to-one function, right? Just by the pigeonhole principle, if I start with a lot of things and hash them to a few things, there have to be multiple things that hash on to at least some of those results. And in fact, it will be many of them. And when we're talking about hashing sort of, you know, many thousands of bits down to a few hundreds of bits, you know that that ratio is, in fact, very large. There are many, many messages that will hash onto a given hash value. Okay, we design the hash functions to produce fixed-size message digests. That's just another term for the result of the hash function. But given that, even given that it is many to one, we want it to be difficult to, given a particular fingerprint or hash value, to find a different message that hashes onto that same value. Okay? So, one of the things that comes of this is that the fixed size here has to be actually quite large. Right? Otherwise it's too easy to find things that hash to the same value. Okay. So all of that's fine. Internet checksum, CRC values, they're all way too short, essentially, to provide good hash functions. It's too easy to find other values. But assuming that we have a good hash function, then digital signature is relatively easy. We take the message, we hash it, we sign the hash, producing an encrypted version of the hash. And it's important to note here that the plus in these diagrams means concatenation. Okay? Not exclusive OR, as it often does in these discussions. Here it means concatenation. So we get M concatenated with the encrypted version of its hash. Verification takes the message and the encrypted hash, splits them apart. Alice hashes the message part. She checks the signature on the... She checks the encryption on the signature, compares them, and if they're equal, then she believes that the message really did come from Bob. Okay. Don't use MD5. For the last 7 or 8 years, it's been known how to, at least in theory, sometimes produce collisions for MD5. So it's a little surprising that a 2013 textbook still says that. The secure hash algorithm family, there's SHA-1, SHA-128, SHA-256. That family is okay, and the longer versions are better. Right? If you can tolerate the latency associated with both computing them and transmitting them. Right? One of the issues about doing all this stuff that we run across in our research is that notice that if you want to send a particular message, you've now made it longer by the size of the encrypted hash of the message. If you're operating over communication links that can barely accommodate the message that you started with, then adding this additional data may actually push you out of the operating envelope. Another thing that happens is that it takes a certain amount of time to do this signature. Like I said, it may take sort of upwards of 40 milliseconds to do the combination of these two things. If you need an answer faster than that, you just can't do this. Okay? So you have to consider those things. Okay, coming back to this slide, this is the one we saw before, and has to do with associating Alice's public key with Alice. Okay. Our signature capability now allows us the ability to do something about that. So this is just a fanciful story that's associated with the slide on the previous page. In which Trudy masquerades as Bob. It's not the previous page. It's another situation where Trudy masquerades as Bob this time, by lying about the binding between a public key and a real world entity. Okay? So to get around that, the world has moved to the idea of certification authorities. And certification authorities take it upon themselves to say that a particular public key belongs to a particular real world entity. How they do that, of course, is sort of up to their own processes, but you can think of things like when you, as a business, want to get your public key certified, you have to send in something that says, you know, where you are and your business numbers and other things. They may actually call you up, right, and say, did you do this? Write you a letter at your registered address that they could look up in the Dun and Bradstreet numbers and the like. That's providing proof of identity. The certificate authority then creates a document, right, that says, this public key belongs to Bob. And I'm sort of standing behind that fact, that this public key belongs to Bob. And then the certificate authority signs that certificate so that somebody who gets that certificate can look at it and see that certificate authority is attesting to that binding. Okay, all well and good. What are the vulnerabilities in this process?
You can't trust the certificate authority.
Right. So first of all, the certificate authority may actually be duped. May be dishonest or duped, right? It has happened. There have been multiple instances of certificate authorities that have issued certificates for keys that do not belong to Microsoft and Google and Amazon, but nevertheless the certificates they issue say they do. Okay? So that's one issue here. And you know, the world really hopes that certificate authorities that do that sort of get given the death sentence as far as whether they're ever trusted again. But that has not happened, actually, and some of those certificate authorities that have made those mistakes continue to be trusted. What's the second hole? Second hole is that there's really no place to stand here, right? So it's signed by the certificate authority. All right. Well, how do you know that's a certificate authority?
Someone forged the certificate authority signature, essentially, or
no? Just how do you bootstrap this process, right? How do you know what the keys are for the certificate authorities? Well, in sort of the world, there has evolved a set of processes that try to implement this story. Why is this here? See if I can find them. Where do they live? I can never find things. Options. There we go. The browser manufacturers have taken it upon themselves to bless various certificate authorities by incorporating their keys, essentially their self-signed keys, into the data that's distributed with browsers. Now, you're you. Tautology. You are you. You're going off to a website and using HTTPS. We'll talk about sort of how that works in a second. But the website has provided a certificate that says, you know, the real world entity corresponding to this server is such and so. And your browser says, okay, that corresponds to one of these, that's been signed by one of these certificates. Okay, who are you trusting now? Who, and remember about trust, right? Trust is the guy, you're trusting the guy who can cause you a lot of trouble if he doesn't do what he says he did. That's what trust is. Who are you trusting? Well, you're trusting one of, how many are there in here? I don't know. Looks like maybe there are several hundred entities, most of which you've never heard of, right? Located all over the world. This looks like it might be in Turkey, you know, or I've added that one. That one doesn't come built in. Right? That's who you're trusting. Oh yes, we all trust Wells Fargo so much. Okay? That's who you're trusting. Now, you're also trusting it, you're, that level of trust that you're putting in these things is somewhat mitigated by the fact that you're trusting Mozilla, in this case, the maker of Firefox, who produced who produced this list of certificates and incorporated it with their browser. How do you know that the Firefox browser that you're running and the list of certificates that you have actually came from Mozilla? I don't know. All right. Okay. So there are lots of potential holes in this process, is what I want to emphasize. But notice that the world goes on. Okay? We mostly managed to buy our stuff off of Amazon. We mostly managed to have our searches take place at Google and not someplace else. We mostly managed to not disclose our passwords in conversations that we have with our mail servers. We mostly managed to talk to our mail servers and not other people's mail servers that rely on this stuff. Okay? So, it's great to have this technology of public key cryptography and certificates and all that, but we do need to keep in mind that there are potentially places of vulnerability where somebody intending to do something nasty could get in and do it at least on a small scale. I think it would be very difficult for somebody to get in and sort of do things on a very large scale. It would be noticed. It would be noticed in the real world. Right? If all of a sudden we're all ordering stuff from Amazon and we're getting large charges on our credit cards and no merchandise in the mail, you know, that'll be noticed. But if somebody wants to attack a little bit, maybe. Were you guys around in Pullman? Yeah, you must have been around in Pullman. I think it was last year when there were a lot of credit card, fraudulent credit card charges being made in Pullman. You know, it got noticed. This year, apparently something similar is going on in the Spokane area. And again, they suspect that there is somewhere in that area, there is either a flaw in the system that's reporting credit card charges to the banks, or they suspected here in Pullman that there was actually a device that had been installed on a credit card reader, one or more credit card readers, that was directly reporting numbers to the people who attacked it. So anyway, but again, life goes on. We survive.
What happened 3 or 4 years ago when they had someone with the V for Vendetta mask break into the system? Someone broke into all of the wireless projectors and basically played a clip.
Oh, yeah. The They broke into these systems on these computer systems to do that.
That wasn't a network hack.
It was not a network hack. They had actually come into the rooms, I believe, and they've done things since then to lock them down better. Basically, they went from a system. This is kind of interesting. They went from a system where it used to be when you came into this room, you had to log in to use the system. Now you don't log in to use the system, and that's better. Interesting, isn't it? Because what they did to make that possible was make it just not possible for these systems to do the kinds of things that you can do when you're logged in. Right? All you could do is turn on the projector, project things, do appropriate things for this room. You can't go off to anywhere else and do anything the way you could before when you were logged in, because you were logged in. Right? You had credentials to do things. So it's actually kind of interesting. And I, as I said before about the Wi-Fi, I mean, I think I would be much happier if the Wi-Fi were just open. You know, that would be a lot safer, to my way of thinking, than it currently is, where you use your network ID password to log in and you store that on your cell phone and your laptop computer and all those things in conditions where you and I don't know whether they are adequately protected. There's no way for us to know all of that about all the devices that we use. And we're the technology guys. Think about everybody who's just unaware that it's even an issue, including the people who designed it, apparently. Okay, so wrong one. So other ways of going about this include things like PGP, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy. Instead of using certificate authorities, you actually get your friends to attest to the binding of your key. You get a lot of friends to attest, and then people know your friends, and they know their friends trust them. You assign levels of trust to all those things, and you come up with a scheme by which you can learn about other people's public keys and associate some varying level of trust with them. I'm not sure that part actually works, because it seems way too complicated for people to understand in an environment where they have to do it multiple times per day. But it's an alternative. Okay, so that just explains how it works. All right, so next time we'll talk about how to secure email and talk about SSL, or more appropriately, TLS these days. Yes?
When will you assign the interface?
I'd better do that today, hadn't I?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like right after break, isn't it? Like Monday.
Yeah,
Wednesday.
Monday.
I'll extend the deadline.
The
more important thing is to assign it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering why the multi-threaded solution is necessary for the project tree. I'm just wondering what we use it for.
Okay, so you're probably not actually going to use it, but what it allows is it allows your proxy server to support simultaneous clients. And that's,
so like multiple,
that's an important...
Not multiple web pages, but...
actually, multiple different computers or sessions all using it at the same time.
Okay. Because mine works without it, and I was just wondering what it was used.
Yeah, that's what it's for. And it's and the reason I require it is because it's a important technique to know about network programming. It isn't that it's particularly interesting for this project, but rather you need to know how to do it.
That
makes sense. Uh-huh. I'm sorry.
I have some questions about the return types of send and receive.
Oh.
Like when it returns, what it means when it returns zero.
Okay.
One of them, in the annotated pages, it says if it returns zero, it means there's an error. Another person
no.
Coming up.
It not an error. The other person is gone. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. That's right.
Is that in the case of both? Because I was having an issue on the first project.
Uh-huh.
Where I was trying to check the return codes or the return value.
Mm-hmm.
And the man page doesn't say anything. I think it's send doesn't say anything about returning zero.
Oh. So on a TCP connection. If you send and it returns zero.
Wait, I'm not sure, but I think it was send. It was one of the two.
I don't think that should happen on a TCP connection. Unless you've closed. Unless, for some reason, it's closed.
I know it's the first project. Because I hadn't started up the other side yet, and so it was sending or trying to receive, and so it wasn't. I would get weird.
Okay. Yeah. So just like with ordinary file descriptors, a receive that returns zero means that the other end is gone. Close the connection. Send that returns zero probably indicates the same thing, although I didn't think that would actually happen.
Yeah,